So if a person gets tired after they eat, that's a clue that they're getting an insulin surge. Well, chronic insulin surges activate what are called glial cells in the brain, and this creates a significant neuroinflammatory response in the brain that helps degenerate it, and especially in areas of the brain that are associated with dementia, the medial temporal lobe.
Hello and welcome to the Ultimate Health Podcast, episode 267. Jesse Chapp is here with Marty Wasserman, and we are here on a weekly basis to take your health to the next level.
Each week, we will bring you inspiring and informative conversations about health and wellness, covering topics of nutrition, lifestyle, fitness, mindset, and so much more.
And this week, Dr. Datis Karazian is back on the show. He's a clinical research scientist, academic professor, and functional medicine healthcare provider. He specializes in developing evidence-based models to treat autoimmune, neurological, and unidentified chronic diseases using diet, nutrition, and lifestyle medicine. Datis is the author of Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms? And Why Isn't My Brain Working? And today we're going deep on brain health.
If you want to catch our last episode all about thyroid health, go and check out episode 256. It is a great show and you will learn so much. And you will also on today's show all about brain health. So here is some of what we get into. We talk about the impact of stress on your brain, how chronic elevated cortisol is associated with dementia, how exercise improves circulation and brain function, supplements that boost circulation, how elevated insulin levels cause brain inflammation, and best ways to support your brain. So we are getting into all things brain today. I hope you're ready. Here we go with Datis Karazian. Hi, Datis. How are you? Welcome back to the show.
Good. Thanks, Marty. Pleasure to be back.
It's great to have you on the show again, Datis. And today we are talking all about brain health. Last time we had you on the show was all about thyroid. This time we're going into the brain. And I want to start off with a quote from the book where you say, nothing is more damaging to the brain than stress. So I want to start here, talk about stress and talk about the impact on the brain. And to start this off, I want to talk about how stress leads to poor circulation, which is going to starve the brain of oxygen. So I'm just going to let you take that and roll with it.
Yeah, if you look at all the studies on stress, it is really scary. I mean, the first thing that happens with chronic stress is that the brain itself atrophies. And this is a global atrophy. So the entire brain just becomes much smaller and less effective with chronic stress. Now, stress impacts different areas of the brain, also more devastating than other areas. So there's an area of the brain called the medial temporal lobe or the hippocampus. And this is an area of the brain that controls memory, long-term memory, and it also controls cortisol rhythms throughout the day. So in this medial temporal lobe area, there are cortisol receptor sites. And when you're under stress, you release a lot of cortisol. So what they find is this, what they call an excitotoxic model, that if you have chronic elevations of cortisol for a long period of time, since this area of the brain, the medial temporal lobe, is so rich in these receptors, that you get this massive overload and excitotoxic degeneration of the region is actually associated with dementia. So there's significant effects globally, meaning the entire brain, with stress, but very specific devastating damage to the areas of the brain associated with dementia, which is involved with long-term memory. So those are the effects of chronic stress on the brain, but then as you also said, there's vascular effects. So when we have a stress response, we go into a fight or flight response also, and we get a release of hormones called catecholamines, and then these cause massive vasoconstriction, and what we end up is having decreased peripheral circulation or decreased blood flow to the brain, which has its own devastating effects on just brain function in general. When we look at stress, we sometimes think, oh, you know, it's okay. Once we get out of stress, we'll be fine. But chronic stress has some long-term damaging effects on the brain. So a lot of these changes, especially these associated with atrophy or excitotoxic models, are not reversible after a long period of time.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into the poor circulation. And other than stress, what other things lead to poor oxygenation of the brain?
So you can have various things that lead to poor oxygenation of the brain. The number one reason is really lack of endothelial nitric oxide synthase. This is a hormone released in the vascular system. In the past few years, people may not know this, but the vascular system, the blood vessels in our body, got recategorized as an endocrine gland. And the blood vascular system, there's an area inside the cell walls called endothelium. It's been found to release hormones. And one of the key hormones it releases, or signaling agent that it releases, is called endothelial nitric oxide synthase. And this causes dilation of the blood vessels, so you have healthy circulation. And this is triggered actually by increasing your heart rate. So one of the things we know is that when people become sedentary and when people stop moving around, they stop the production of ENOS. So this leads to very, very poor circulation. So a lot of times you see people, when they exercise, their circulation improves, and they see this change, and that's because of ENOS. But long-term sedentary activity leads to long-term reduction of this hormone, and then you get decreased blood flow and circulation all over the body. So that's first the most common thing, is just sedentary lifestyle leads to very poor circulation. Now, with most people, you combine that with, let's say, stress response. You combine that with factors such as maybe a metabolic issue, like a thyroid issue. Then you start to really add these all up, and you get people that have massive mechanisms impacting blood flow in the brain. And then there's diseases like anemia or any kind of heart issue, like mitral prolapse, where you can't get enough blood flow out from your heart, or someone has a chronic pulmonary issue or lung issue. Those all add up to impacting the oxygenation of our brain.
So let's come back to exercise and open this up a little bit. When you talk about exercise to improve circulation, are we talking about just aerobic exercise, or does strength training impact this as well?
So all types of exercise impact endothelial nitric oxide synthase. The key thing is that when you exercise, as blood circulates against this endothelium blood vessel, you release this gas. So the more intense the exercise, the harder your heart has to work, the more activity you get to push out ENOS. So if you go on a casual walk and there's not great demand for your heart to really work, it doesn't have the same effect as, let's say, sprint. But it doesn't matter if you do weight training or if you do aerobic activity, as long as there is increased demands placed upon your vascular system and your heart to pump out blood. So the more aggressively your heart has to pump out blood, the more of this ENOS compound you release, and then the better your circulation becomes.
Are there certain supplements that we can take to help boost circulation?
There are several supplements that have been shown to impact this ENOS system. The two most published ones are hawthorn extract and vincositine. We use those all the time with patients that have poor circulation issues and have poor brain function. I talk about this extensively in my brain book and cite a lot of the research in there. And there's been at least 40 studies on vincositine with stroke patients. And even after patients receive a stroke, that vincositine can help get blood flow to the brain and help with recovery. And these agents also not only improve blood flow to the brain, but they also reduce hypertension. So this has a balancing effect on people that have high blood pressure, but it doesn't lower blood pressure with people that are normal. So it just has this positive modulating effect on getting healthy circulation to the system. I personally take vincositine every single day because of those benefits.
So I want to get into brain nutrition and talk about blood sugar imbalances. Something you say in your book specifically is that the only effect eating should have is to remove hunger. Can you explain what you mean by this?
Right, and this is really where a lot of the research has been in the past few years, to the point where there are researchers using the term type 3 diabetes as being dementia. And this is really because they found insulin has such a profound impact, if it's elevated chronically, on causing inflammatory reactions in the brain leading to dementia. So when we eat, we release insulin to help us convert our circulating glucose from our meal into our cells. But if people constantly overeat or eat too much sugar or way too much carbs, then there's an increased production of insulin. And the way you know that's happening is if you get tired after you eat. So if a person gets tired after they eat, that's a clue that they're getting an insulin surge. Well, chronic insulin surges activate what are called glial cells in the brain, and this creates a significant neuroinflammatory response in the brain that helps degenerate it, and especially in areas of the brain that are associated with dementia, the medial temporal lobe. So we're very concerned about people that have high blood sugar levels or a tendency towards diabetes or constantly get tired after meals. And then we're also concerned about the hypoglycemics. These are people that forget to eat throughout the day. When they eat nothing like substantial. So they have like a muffin or a coffee for a meal. Those people also suffer from insulin spikes, because when their blood sugar levels drop, there's a release of cortisol and catecholamines to get their glycogen or their stored glucose converted back so they can have energy. But they also release insulin to try to get that glucose to the cell. So both low blood sugar people or high blood sugar people are really getting these insulin surges throughout the day, which are devastating for the brain. So one of the key things you always look at as a clinician is to ask a patient how they feel after they eat. If they feel tired, when are they getting insulin surges? If they feel like they're getting energized and can function again after they eat, then we know that they're probably on the hypoglycemia side. The normal response after you eat a meal is to have no change in your energy levels, just to have your appetite managed so you're no longer hungry. So you combine, let's say, for example, a person who's got a little bit of insulin resistance and you get a little bit of poor circulation, a little bit of stress, now you have layers and layers of mechanisms that start to degenerate the brain.
So I know we talked heavily about the impact of gluten on our thyroid health and on health in general in our first conversation. And we've talked about that many times on the podcast before. So let's talk about gluten in relation to brain health and what this is doing to affect our brains.
We published a study back in 2014 regarding gluten, and we took 400 healthy blood donors. We checked them, and these are blood donors that have no disease and no symptoms. So we tested them for antibodies to gluten. But when you check antibodies to gluten, gluten has lots of different epitopes or different branches of the protein. So we checked alpha-gliadin, gamma-gliadin, glutenin, wheat-germagglutinin, deaminated-gliadin, and all the different branches of gliadin. And what we found with a healthy population with absolutely no symptoms, about 15% of them had antibodies to gluten. And, you know, most people only are worried about celiac disease because they think it's about less than 1%, or gluten sensitivity maybe around 3% or more. But we found when we check all the epitopes, even with even the healthiest people in the population, we find about 15% of them react to gluten proteins. We then took those subjects that reacted to gluten and we checked them for neurological antibodies. Myelin basic protein, myelo-oligodendrocytic protein. These are antibodies in the brain that cause neuroinflammation and damage against the myelin sheath of neurons. So what we found was nearly 50% of the people that had antibodies against wheat proteins had brain antibodies also, meaning that they were reacting and having a neuroinflammatory response with a high degree of correlation between those two. So we published that study, and it was actually very shocking to us how many of those people were there. And I'm sure if we checked a population that had neurological symptoms, the numbers would be much higher. But it's very shocking. Now, gluten is just basically a very inflammatory protein to the brain. And more importantly, when you react against food proteins all have an amino acid sequence. And when you make an antibody, your immune system reacts to it. It makes an antibody. Those antibodies then bind to the gluten protein and it gets destroyed. But if the amino acid sequence of a protein is similar to your own body, then antibodies made against that food protein can also bind to the tissue. So with gluten, there's been found that there's significant cross-reactivity between wheat proteins and tissues of the brain. So gluten has molecular mimicry with areas of the brain like the cerebellum. This leads to what's called gluten ataxia. So what we find is that there's a significant and severe inflammatory response with people that make antibodies or have sensitivity to gluten. And this is unassociated with celiac disease to brain inflammation and even cross-reactivity. It is really, really scary. So when someone has poor brain function, we always check for gluten sensitivity and see if they make gluten antibodies. And if they do, I mean, it's definitely something that needs to be removed from their diet.
Let's take this a little further and talk about the connection between gluten and intestinal inflammation and leaky gut. And I'm going to come full circle around after this here, but I want to start by talking about this.
Well, what we know is there's been a lot of research on intestinal permeability or leaky gut. And a lot of this is being done at Harvard Medical School with Fasano at Mass General Hospital. They're also working on different types of drugs to combat leaky gut syndrome at this point, called zonulin blockers. But when the intestinal tight junctions open from chronic inflammation in the digestive tract, what they're also finding is that the protein that opens up the tight junctions called zonulin is the exact same protein that opens up the blood-brain barrier. And there's a high degree of correlation between intestinal permeability and blood-brain barrier permeability. And just last year, we published a paper in the World Journal of Gastroenterology where we measured circulating zonulin levels with individuals that had celiac disease. And what we found was that we could actually see a high degree of correlation between leaky gut and blood-brain barrier permeability by checking different types of proteins like aquaporin and glial fibrillary protein. These are proteins that only show up when the blood-brain barrier gets compromised. So what we now know is that when someone has a leaky gut, they also have compromise of the blood-brain barrier or leaky brain. And this then sets up the stage for significant inflammatory reactions from which you ingest. So if you have an inflammatory diet and food proteins, and then you start to eat those things, that opens up the tight junctions, and not only the gut, but also the brain. And now you open up the brain for inflammatory mediators to come in. And as you inflame the brain starts to degenerate. And I think what you see with just the questions you brought up is you have someone who's got, you know, let's say a sedentary lifestyle, they make less EOS, they have less circulation to the brain. You combine that with someone who's got a little bit of gluten sensitivity and a little bit of breach of their leaky gut and their blood-brain barrier. You combine that with things like blood sugar instability, and they get insulin surges. And as those things each add up, you can devastate brain function, but still you have a patient who doesn't have a neurological disease. So you have all these people walking around wondering why they can't think, focus, and concentrate. But, you know, when they go see the neurologist, they're told they have no disease because it hasn't progressed to the point where it's a neurodegenerative disease yet.
Thanks for making that connection between leaky gut and a leaky blood-brain barrier. And to get into the blood-brain barrier a little bit more, you talk about in the book how you can use GABA to actually test for a leaky blood-brain barrier. So explain about the molecule size and how that can be used for testing.
So one of the things that I talk about in my book is something called the GABA challenge. And GABA is an amino acid that also works as a neurotransmitter in the brain, and you can purchase it over the counter, and it has a sedating effect if it crosses the blood-brain barrier. Now, when you look at the size of molecules that should cross the blood-brain barrier, GABA is much too large to cross the blood-brain barrier. Within the brain itself, the brain makes GABA and has effects on different receptors in the brain to modulate that GABAergic response, they call it. When you ingest GABA, the first thing is that if it works, it's a big clue to you that you have a breach blood-brain barrier, because technically oral ingesting GABA should never cross a healthy blood-brain barrier. It's just impossible for that large molecule to cross unless the blood-brain barrier is breached, and now this larger macromolecule can cross it. So we call that the GABA challenge, and we talk about how you can take a dosage and see if it has an effect with you to get a clue if GABA has any kind of response. Now, this whole theory that I was using in my practice with GABA was based on the research on molecular size and studies of what they were using to measure leaky gut. So they used to do a test called the lactulose mannitol test, where they would have patients ingest a large disaccharide called lactulose, which is a large sugar. Then they would collect urine samples afterwards. And if a person had ingested this sugar solution, and then they had high amounts of urinary levels of this disaccharide, it would indicate they had leaky gut because it's not possible for this large sugar to cross. So it's the same premise with GABA. We have also objective tests besides the GABA challenge. You know, we can measure protein markers like S100B or even blood-brain barrier protein antibodies, and that gives us a more of a objective way to see if someone has a blood-brain barrier breach. But you can use your effects against how you respond to GABA as a clue to what's going on with your blood-brain barrier subjectively.
I want to get back into brain nutrition. There's so many questions I have in this area. And just to simplify things for people to tease, if we can just kind of go over a balanced brain health focused diet, like what are the things that you recommend to our listeners to eat to support brain health, or not eat for that matter, just to give them an overview?
Well, generally speaking, when you look at what the brain needs, it's really no different than what we know to be helpful for health. The brain falls apart with too much insulin. So high sugar diets, high carbohydrate diets are not healthy for the brain. The brain has an intimate connection with the microbiome. The brain got access. And the more diverse the microbiome is, the healthier. You have different types of neuropeptides and secondary messengers impact the brain. All the research shows that microbiome diversity is based on a diverse vegetable diet. So we want lots of different plant fibers in the diet to impact microbiome diversity to have this brain got access effect on the brain.
I'm curious about mushrooms. I saw that come up in the vegetable section as a vegetable not to consume. So what's the theory on that?
I think it's case specific. For most people, it's not that big of a concern, but the key thing is diversity itself. Now, when you look at different aspects of the brain, also needs fatty acids. When you look at fatty acids, essential fatty acids are also very critical for the brain. So flaxseed, nuts and seeds, fish oils, those are things that are there. So it's really, when you look at the diet for the brain, it's very simple. It needs diet that is low in sugar and carbohydrates, high in vegetable and plant proteins, and high in healthy fats. It's what everyone knows. It's published. No one really argues that. The things that are bad for the brain are inflammation and proteins that are very inflammatory. The most common inflammatory proteins are milk protein, wheat protein, egg protein, soy protein. But those should be tested with antibodies to really see if a person really has an inflammatory reaction against them. But ideally, if you're looking at just a general protocol, I would say a gluten dairy-free diet with high amounts of fatty acids and a diverse list of vegetables with limited amounts of carbs and sugars to prevent insulin surges would be the ideal diet for brain.
You touched on fish oil there. Is this a supplement you recommend to most of your patients? And if so, what kind of dosage are you recommending?
Well, when you look at fish oils, there's different components of fish oils. Fish oils have an EPA component and DHA. So there's two types of fatty acids in fish oils. And what they find is that the EPA port officials has a very powerful anti-inflammatory effect, but the DHA portion of fish oils have an effect on the neuron cell membrane and allows the neuron cell membrane to become more flexible and more efficient with neurotransmission. So for me personally, when I'm supplementing with fish oils in my practice, assuming that we've already made change in their diet, we always start with diet first, but if we need to do additional support, if we need to try to get a greater inflammatory response, I'll typically use a fish oil with a higher EPA ratio. And if I'm just trying to get more of a neurotransmission effect because I don't think there's an inflammatory issue, I'll use a high DHEA ratio fish oil. So it really depends on what your clinical goals are.
And I know you're also a big fan of eating regularly every 2 to 3 hours. And it's interesting because there's a lot of talk right now about intermittent fasting and spacing out the time between meals. So just bring us your perspective on why more regular meals you feel are better for brain health.
Well, I think the key is to prevent an insulin surge, but let's talk about fasting and also ketogenic diets too. So in my private practice, when I work with patients, if the patient is severely compromised, is very progressed in a neurodegenerative scale, or is really functioning very, very poorly with brain function, then I will do a ketogenic diet. Once they get into ketosis, that's the only time I use intermittent fasting. So once a person gets into ketosis, what you'll see is clinically, we'll have patients measure their ketones with urine strips. And when they go into ketogenic diet, which is a high fat diet, very limited sugar and carbohydrates, and they use a modified ketogenic diet, which where they do less than 30 grams of carbohydrates per day, whereas the strict ketogenic diet is less than 10 grams, so we use a modified ketogenic diet. But when patients follow a modified ketogenic diet, what they'll notice is it takes about 2 to 5 days before they get into ketosis, where they start to measure urinary ketones. And after about 2 to 3 weeks of being on that, they'll notice being on the same diet, they stop making urinary ketones. That's called ketone adapted. And then once they're ketone adapted, I have them start fasting. But once they get into ketosis and they're working off ketones, fasting is really the best time to have them follow that protocol. If you take a hypoglycemic that's still having blood sugar fluctuations and starts fasting, or you take a person who's pre-diabetic and they start having insulin surge and start fasting, they completely fall apart. So for me, and the way I work with my patients, is if they have significant neurodegenerative issues, I'll go on a ketogenic diet because the brain is more efficient working on ketones, and you stop the high degree of insulin surges on the ketogenic diet. Then once they're keto-adapted, I do fasting. But for some people that don't need to take it that far into a ketogenic diet, we'll just make sure their blood sugars are stable throughout the day so they prevent those insulin surges. That's the key concept. So it's all about insulin.
Now we're going to take a quick break from our chat with Tatis to give a shout out to our show partner, Spruce.
I'm super excited to share with you guys that Spruce has just come out with brand new bars. Bars full of collagen, ready to go. And they come in 3 different flavors, chocolate almond butter, double chocolate beet, and lemon coconut. And what's unique about these bars is that they are full of 7 grams of wild-caught marine collagen. And they're full of clean, real food ingredients like hemp seeds and cacao and almond butter and coconut. They are also low in naturally occurring sugars. They are definitely paleo-friendly, gluten and grain-free. And they're just such a great snack to bring on the go because of their balanced nutritional composition, which is 14 grams of protein, 15 grams of good fats, and 9 grams of fiber. So if you haven't gotten your hands on the Spruce bars yet, and you probably haven't because they're brand new, you've got to order some today. I recommend trying all 3 flavors. They are great on the go. Give them a try.
And as a listener of our show, you get 10% off all your Spruce purchases. To take advantage, go to ultimatehealthpodcast.com/spruce. Again, that URL is ultimatehealthpodcast.com/spruce. And Spruce is spelled S-P-R-O-O-S. Currently, Spruce is only shipping to Canada, but U.S. listeners, hang tight. They're going to be shipping over the border pretty soon. Go and load up on some Spruce bars today. You are going to love them.
And now a shout out from our other show partner, Thrive Market. If you're in the USA and you're looking to start shopping online for some good quality health food, check out Thrive Market. They've got it all. And something you can look for that definitely goes hand in hand with today's episode is good quality fats and oils. And the beauty is that Thrive Market has both plant-based and animal fats, and you can stock up on all of them. So if you want to choose from things like coconut oil, avocado oil, olive oil, duck fat, ghee, and a variety of fish oils, whether you want to take it in capsule form or liquid form. And the best part is that all the products at Thrive Market are 25 to 50% off of regular retail value. In addition, you're going to get a 30-day free trial plus free shipping. And as a listener of a show, you're going to get an extra 25% off your order. So get online to Thrive Market and start shopping today.
To take advantage of this incredible offer, it's super easy to do. Just go to ultimatehealthpodcast.com/thrivemarket. Again, that URL is ultimatehealthpodcast.com/thrivemarket. Go and take advantage of this incredible offer today. And now back to our chat with Atiece. Earlier we talked about leaky gut, and I want to come back to the gut and talk specifically about the gut-brain axis and how communication is actually going both ways, from the brain down to the gut and the gut back to the brain, and the connection here via the vagus nerve. So if you could just open that up, and I really want to dig into this.
Yeah, and I published a paper on the traumatic brain injuries and the brain axis, and it reviews a lot of these relationships, so I can give you a link to that as well. Basically, there is what they call canalized pathways and non-canalized pathways, so let me explain that. Canalized pathways means there's an actual anatomical connection between the brain and the gut. The brainstem has an outreaching nerve called the vagus nerve, and it goes all the way from the brainstem to the entire gut. When I used to teach brain dissection and neuroanatomy, we used to dissect the brain and then have my students put their hand on the brainstem, find the vagus nerve, and follow all the way down to the gut. And you can see this vagus nerve is really big, and it goes to all parts of the gut. So there is an anatomical connection between the vagus nerve to the gut and the brain. And it's a bidirectional pathway. So neuropeptides and neurotransmitters and neurochemicals, they communicate back and forth between the gut and brain. So it's not separate tissue. It's actually one big tissue. And they go through the, what's called the enteric nervous system, through the vagus nerve to the brainstem and up and down. So those are called canalized pathway. Then there's non-canalized pathway, which means not an anatomical pathway, but pathways through chemicals. So the gut itself releases what are called postbiotics, lipopolysaccharides. It releases neuropeptides, it releases growth factors. It creates a lot of different messenger compounds that can cross the blood-brain barrier and then have effects on the brain itself. So the gut and the brain are constantly communicating with each other. And when the brain gets injured or dysfunctional, the gut has manifestations. And when the gut is imbalanced and impaired, then the brain has manifestations. And there's been a lot of research now the past 10 years. There's been a lot of excitement in this brain-gut axis. So people are finding that when people have changes in their gut microbiome that can impact their depression, or if they have a leaky gut, there's been studies that show that's linked to depression. There's also studies that show when people get traumatic brain injuries, they immediately get inflammation in their gut. So it's really, really fascinating how these two pathways are communicating with each other.
I want to talk more about the vagus nerve and its connection with the gut. And how do we know specifically if this connection is being impaired?
So in a clinical setting, we always... the way we evaluate the vagus nerve is through a cranial nerve exam. So the vagus nerve synapse is an area of the brainstem, and it's in the lower pontine area. And there's a vagal motor nuclei, and what's called a nucleus ambiguus, and these control blood flow and autonomic function to the gut and motility or muscular contractions of the gastrointestinal tract. So what we have patients do is we just go through your typical cranial nerve exam. So if you've ever been to a doctor and they ask you to say, ah, and they look at your throat, that's testing the vagus. What they're looking for is the little punching bag, your palate, and the arches that surround that, your muscles, palatine muscles, to see if they move. So when you have that test done with your doctor, they're actually looking at your vagus nerve function. And also the gag reflex, where they take a tongue blade and stick it back your throat, see if you have normal gag reflex. Those are all vagal responses, because the vagus nerve not only controls the smooth muscles of your palate to have a gag reflex and to move your palate up, but also directly fires to your gut to impact motility or have your intestines move food across. So when you see impairments in someone's gag reflex or their palatine muscles when they say, ah, and that gives us a clue that their vagus nerve may not be functioning so well. The other key thing is many times when patients notice that they have a hard time swallowing. So like a lot of times in practice, a lot of patients come in and they'll say, listen, if you're going to recommend supplements for me, please make sure there are not a lot of pills and maybe more powders or liquids because I have a hard time taking supplements and swallowing. Those are all clues to us that their vagus nerve function may be impaired.
So I want to take some time now and talk about different exercises that we can do to strengthen the vagus nerve if we notice that it's impaired and not functioning optimally.
Sure. So, you know, you have to understand from a conventional neurology model, neurodegenerative, it has, you know, it's a disease, you get it, how much you can do, and maybe manage the symptoms with a drug that controls tremors or a drug that may, for a short period of time, impact neurotransmitters, impact memory. But in a functional neurology model, we're always trying to find out what areas of the brain are starting to show signs of degeneration And then how do we activate those areas to develop plasticity through diet, nutrition, lifestyle, and even through brain exercises? So if we see a patient has a poorly functioning vagus nerve, then we try to activate the vagus. So the same palatine muscles that we examine, we use to activate the vagus. So we have patients gargle with water very aggressively. That activates the vagus nerve. In my book, I talk about those therapies and also using like a tongue blade on the tongue to push down to initiate a gag reflex that activates the vagus. But when you constantly activate the vagus, what you're basically doing is you're getting neurons to activate. And when neurons activate, they start to branch. So each neuron has a branch, like a tree has a branch, and they connect with other neurons. So when you start to have degenerative changes in an area of the brain, or if you start to have injury to areas of the brain, then your only chance to have function back is if these neurons that are still healthy start to branch into other neurons that are healthy, and then you can restore function. So a lot of times when we see people that have impaired vagal function, we'll have them do gargling exercises or tongue blade exercises to really activate those pathways and get that branching to occur, what's called plasticity.
So how long does it take for this branching to take effect? Is it something that happens over a couple of days, a couple of weeks? And how often are they doing the exercises? Is this multiple times a day or once a day?
When we do have patients do vagal exercises, sometimes the effects are immediate. So if someone has chronic constipation and they start gargling for, let's say, 2 to 5 minutes, they'll notice they'll have the problem once again right after that. In other people, it may take several days to have an effect, but it varies from person to person. So that's like the typical response we see with vagal nerve exercises. But the other question you asked was, how long does the branching take? And that's called plasticity, neuronal branching. And neuronal branching depends on multiple factors. So the more information you have in your body, the less potential you have to have neurons branch to each other. You also have to have things which are growth factors. So brain-derived neurotrophic factor is one of the key ones. The higher your BDNF levels are in your body, the more potential you have for exercises and for neuron branching to take place. So if someone is really exercising a lot, just any kind of physical activity, that increases BDNF. If you take someone who's really inflamed and is in a sedentary position where they're having high amounts of inflammatory reactions in their brain, and they're also very low in BDNF activity because they're not really moving around and activating their body, then their chance for axonal branching or plasticity development is totally different than someone, for example, who's exercising routinely and is on an anti-inflammatory diet. So those factors all take into account how someone responds to any type of brain exercise.
Tatis, I'd love for you to talk about coffee enemas and how these are distending the intestines, and what that does is it actually activates the vagus nerve.
Yeah, I also talk about this in my brain book. But one of the other things we do to activate the brain gut access is we do use coffee enemas. So typically people use coffee enemas for constipation issues or try to impact flushing of the gallbladder and liver as a naturopathic model. But for us, from a neurological model, what we want patients to do is to basically do a coffee enema. And then once they do the coffee enema, the caffeine activates what are called cholinergic receptors, acetylcholine receptors in the gut. Those are the smooth muscle receptors to fire. And that causes what's called bowel urgency. So it makes you want to have a bowel movement. What we have patients do for a brain gut access model, we have them do a coffee enema, and then the caffeine activates those receptors. And then when the person has symptoms of having a need to have a bowel movement, we have them try to suppress that as long as they can. And the longer they can suppress that, the more activity they're getting in the brain gut axis. So when you have bowel urgency and you're activating those receptors in the gut, in order for you to suppress your bowel movement, you have to fire what are called frontal pontine vagal pathways to suppress that. So it allows us to really activate the projections from the brain to the vagus down at the gut through bowel suppression. So we see how long they can keep the coffee enema and their contents in. The stronger the caffeine and the longer they can hold it, the greater effects it has on that frontal pontine vagal pathway. And it's the therapy we also use to activate and regenerate the brain gut axis.
I want to take the conversation into brain inflammation. And in the book, you talk about how the brain actually has no pain fibers. So the way to tell if your brain's inflamed is if you start having brain fog. So explain how that happens.
Right. So in order for us to experience pain, we have to have what are called nociceptors that fire through C fibers to our parietal lobe to then have us express the symptom of pain. But neurons in the brain, white matter and gray matter, have no pain fibers. So when there's inflammation, we don't have any pain. When people have headaches or they feel like the brain's hurting, those are vascular responses. But when people have inflammation in their brain, unrelated to vascular involvements, they don't have any pain and they don't have headaches. They just have slowness in their cognitive function. So inflammation slows down the firing speed of neurons. They call that nerve conduction. So when someone is inflamed, their nerve conduction speed goes down dramatically. And for most patients, they kind of explain that as like a brain fog. They have a thought, they can't really get to it. They want to do something and they can't remember what it was. So many times we'll see that with people that have, like, let's say diabetes and their insulin is out of control. Once blood sugar levels go down, their brain fog improves. Or it happens typically after someone, if they have a traumatic brain injury, all of a sudden they have all this brain fog and they have inflammation. And once their inflammation resolves from that, they start to notice that their brain speed comes back. So many times when we see patients with reduced brain speed, which typically gets manifested into symptoms of brain fog or brain slowness and brain activity, we suspect that there may be brain inflammation that's taking place.
So you mentioned diabetes, you mentioned brain injury. Is there any other primary things that are causing brain inflammation?
So anything that's inflammatory to the body has an effect on the brain. And the brain is susceptible to inflammation, and actually the most susceptible tissue to inflammation in the body. So whether you have joint disease like rheumatoid arthritis that's causing inflammation, or any other type of autoimmunity, or multiple chemical or food reactivities, or any kind of underlying inflammatory disease in your body, those inflammatory responses all impact the brain and cause brain inflammation.
And what are the primary ways you're helping patients dampen this inflammation?
So if you take a step back and just ask the question as, let's say, a clinician or a researcher, and go, okay, what dampens brain inflammation? And you do a literature search, and you go, let's say, on the National Library of Medicine or PubMed, and you look at all the papers published on brain inflammation, and you look at the evidence, I think the evidence is pretty clear that the main way to dampen brain inflammation is with dietary flavonoids. Curcumin, turmeric, resveratrol, these all have been shown major anti-inflammatory effects on the brain. Green tea polyphenols. I list a lot of these anti-inflammatory compounds in the citations to the scientific literature in my brain book. And I also want to point out in my brain book, I have 1,000 peer-reviewed references. And if you actually hold the book, it's like a thick brick. Most of the reason the book is so dense is because I cite every single study for each of the comments I make. And the first copy of the book that I got back, we actually had 3,000 references, and the book ended up with being more references than actual content. So we cut it down to 1,000 scientific references. But I just want to point out that when you really are looking at evidence-based medicine, there's a tremendous amount of evidence and safety for using flavonoids to dampen brain inflammation. So we use turmeric, resveratrol, green tea polyphenols, and other types of flavonoids to really dampen brain inflammation. We have them as a band-aid, but then clinically, we're always trying to figure out the underlying cause. Like, do they have insulin surging, as an example we talked about? Or do they have antibodies against a wheat protein, like gluten sensitivity or celiac, that's causing it? Or are all those things part of it? And there are layers and layers that need to be addressed to improve brain function.
So we can't have a discussion about the brain and not get into neurotransmitters. So I want to take some time and get into each of these. And I want to start with acetylcholine. And let's just start by talking about some of the symptoms somebody would notice if this neurotransmitter isn't in balance.
Right. So when we talk about neurotransmitter imbalances, we have to talk about a few things first. It's not always the content of the neurotransmitters. It also relates to how sensitive the receptor sites are for the neurotransmitters, and how quickly they're cleared to have healthy synapses for new ones. So there's a lot of factors involved. And neurotransmitter imbalances aren't just related to low or high levels, but really the whole complex of having the neurotransmitter, having it bind to the receptor having a response, the neurotransmitter being cleared, and then having another receptor available that's open to bind again. So there's a lot of factors. So we use the word neurotransmitter imbalance, that's probably more appropriate than, let's say, deficiency, because it's really a series of effects that take place to cause the neurotransmitter to respond. But one of the most important neurotransmitters, like you said, is acetylcholine. And acetylcholine is really the neurotransmitter that has effects throughout our entire body. But what we notice the most in a clinical setting, and the patient may notice the most, is their effects on memory. So the medial temporal lobe area, which we talked about earlier, where dementia starts, is an acetylcholine-rich receptor. So the pathways associated with long-term memory, our ability to recall events, is acetylcholine-based. So many times when we see patients coming in and they have memory impairments, we try to improve their acetylcholine activity and see if we can get some kind of improvements in those symptoms altogether.
And how do you go about rebalancing acetylcholine?
Well, you can take various substances to debalance acetylcholine pathways. Huperzine is a botanical that has been shown to bind to acetylcholine receptors. L-acetylcarnitine is also a very powerful compound that binds to the receptors. And I summarize and list the research for each of those different compounds in my book. Even natural galantamine is a substance that can bind to these receptors. There's some really good research on these compounds and its effect with dementia and memory loss. So those are the key ones.
So in practice, before you get into helping balance neurotransmitters, how quickly are you getting to this? Are you looking at things like the blood sugar and some of the other stuff we were talking about before you look at balancing the neurotransmitter specifically?
With brain function, one of the things that we're looking for is where are they along the scale? Now, if they're barely functioning and I can't think and focus and concentrate, we don't start with the neurotransmitters. That's something that usually gets addressed when you deal with things like blood sugar issues and factors that impact oxygen to the brain and circulation and blood flow and brain gut access issues and so forth. But someone else can also come in and those things are all healthy and they just have some memory impairments and they just want to have better focus and concentration or better recall. That's when we start to work with the neurotransmitters. So it's really on the bottom of list of priorities when we look at improving someone's brain function. This is kind of opposite of what many practitioners practice. They try to look at brain function as a neurotransmitter deficiency and boost them up with things like St. John's wort or other botanicals, hoping to get an effect, but they're not really addressing the underlying mechanisms that are involved with neurotransmitter function itself or the factors that really impact brain physiology.
So let's get into serotonin and symptoms of this not being balanced.
Sure. When you look at serotonin symptoms, when you have serotonin imbalances, there's obviously the aspect of depression. But the key thing with serotonin is what we see clinically with patients that have serotonin imbalances is when you ask them what they like to do, there really is nothing. So they kind of lose their motivation and zest for life. So you go, what's your favorite meal? They don't really have one. What's your favorite song? What's your favorite thing to do? What really brings you joy or happiness? If they have none of those things that they can recall, that's typically what we see with low serotonin activity. So it's a complete loss of excitement and motivation to do things. So when we see that, we start to think that there's some serotonin imbalances. And in my brain book, I list all the other symptoms, and if they all clump together, we start to suspect that there could be some imbalances in the serotonin system.
And if you're trying to boost serotonin with a patient, what are your thoughts on using 5-HTP versus tryptophan?
So the literature shows both 5-HTP and tryptophan have an effect on raising serotonin levels. And some people argue one side or the other. Some people believe 5-HTP is better because it's one step closer to serotonin. Some people believe tryptophan is better because it allows the body to gate into 5-HTP sooner. But at the end of the day, these are just personal philosophies. The research shows they both work, and natural substances like St. John's wort also work as a natural SSRI. So there's some individual uniqueness, and they can try either one of those, tryptophan or 5-HTP or St. John's wort, to have an effect on the serotonin system.
So let's move into GABA and talk about some of the symptoms somebody might be experiencing if they're not in balance.
Well, GABA imbalances are one of the most common imbalances out there. And GABA is the calming down neurotransmitter. It inhibits the brain, and the brain needs to be inhibited at all times, so it can gate and function properly. So when people have GABA symptoms, the key thing is they have a restless mind. They can't shut their mind off. They have severe anxiety. They have restlessness. Those are all the key symptoms of GABA imbalances.
And when somebody's experiencing these imbalances and you're trying to bring them back into balance, what different botanicals are you using?
Well, the compounds that have been shown in the literature to have an effect on these GABAergic receptors, the main ones are valerian root extract and passion flower extract. They have compounds that bind to the GABA receptor. There's also phenibut, spelled P-H-E-N-I-B-U-T, that's very effective on binding the GABA receptors. These are all over the counter. But the thing is, GABA receptors are very complex. There's three subtypes, A, B, and C, and there's over 20 versions of each subtype. And these natural compounds, we don't know to which different variations of these subtypes they bind to, and lots of patients have very diverse genotypes or gene uniquenesses to some of these GABA receptors. So if anxiety runs in your family, you may have a GABA C receptor polymorphism type 20 instead of type 23 or type 21, and you may not respond to those flavonoids, where someone else may respond to passion flower. So we don't have the ability in a clinical setting to test those things, but when we look at the science of these GABA receptors, they are quite complex. And even though we have some studies of natural substances binding to them, we don't yet know how to connect the specific genotype variations with these natural plant compounds. So some people have an effect with natural GABA responses like flame root, passion flower, and peanut butter, or kava kava, and some people don't. But I think most people notice some dampening effect with those substances, and those are things that we can use to put a band-aid to impact the GABA system.
Now we're going to take another quick break from our chat with Tatis to give a shout-out to our show partner, Four Sigmatic.
The incredible team at Four Sigmatic has come out with a fabulous product, and this is called the Mushroom Focus Shot, and this is your ready-to-go energy drink. It is a potent concentrate of lion's mane and rhodiola, and it's got some caffeine from guayusa. It is such a great pick-me-up in the middle of the day. Jesse and I are having one of these before our interviews. It's fabulous. You feel focused, you feel energized, and you feel on without all that junk that's typically added to most energy drinks. Not something that I've ever had before, but I know a lot of people are drinking these. Switch it over. Get your hands on the Mushroom Focus Shot. These things are so good.
They are incredible. And as a listener of our show, you get an incredible deal on all your Four Sigmatic purchases, 10% off. And to take advantage, all you need to do is go to ultimatehealthpodcast.com/4sigmatic. Again, that URL is ultimatehealthpodcast.com/4sigmatic. For listeners in the US and Canada, you can bundle your order together, spend $100 or more, and you get free shipping. Go and get yourself some of these mushroom shots today and supercharge your brain.
And now a shout out from other show partner, Sun Warrior. If you're looking for an alternative to fish oil because that's not your thing, Sunwear has an awesome plant-based omega-3 supplement, and this is complete with DHA and EPA from algae, and it's totally sustainably sourced, and the ingredients that are in this, and by taking an omega-3 supplement, you are helping combat inflammation, you're helping cardiovascular health, and it's also promoting healthy vision, joints, and brain health. So if you want to get your hands on an omega-3 supplement that is plant-based, go ahead and get your hands on the Sun Warrior omega-3 today.
And as a listener of our show, you're going to get 10% off all your Sun Warrior purchases. To take advantage, go to ultimatehealthpodcast.com/SW. Again, that URL is ultimatehealthpodcast.com/SW. And again, for listeners in the US and Canada, you can bundle your order together, spend $100 or more, and you get free shipping. Go and try out this omega-3 supplement today. We know you're going to love it. And now back to our chat with Tatis.
So let's get into dopamine.
Sure. Dopamine is the other major neurotransmitter pathway. And when dopamine levels go down, the key thing is lack of motivation and drive. So you know, a person's ability to get a project done or finish a project or to want to take on projects and just the general concept of motivation is all related to dopamine. So we see a person who isn't excited or motivated to do anything, they have all the passion to do it, whereas the person with low serotonin doesn't care, doesn't have the passion to do anything. The person with low dopamine wants to do it, they just can't initiate and get themselves to finish or start a project. Those are all the key patterns of low dopamine.
And you talk about in the book how when you see a patient with low dopamine, they actually can have trouble staying on the program you give them. So explain what's happening there.
Wow, you guys have really read the book. Good job. Thank you for reading it.
It was great.
So one of the things that we see is, you know, as a clinician, whenever you're evaluating a case, you're always looking for why the case can fail. And whenever you see a patient come in and you see that they have seen really talented practitioners, and you wonder, like, why are they in your office? Because these practitioners are pretty good at what they do and they should have been able to resolve this. It's always a red flag with dopamine when you start to ask them, like, what happened? You saw this person. What do they recommend? And they say they recommended this, this, and that. And then you hear that and you go, well, that sounds reasonable. How'd you do? They go, well, I never really followed through with it. And then you hear that from one practitioner to the next practitioner to the next practitioner. That's a clinical presentation of someone that has low dopamine. So they're in a really difficult situation because they have the desire to improve. They just don't have the motivation to make it happen. So in those cases, we have to get, hopefully they have a very supportive spouse that can get on board. And typically what we see in a clinical practice setting is like the spouse is worn out because the spouse is, you know, has gotten to the point where they've made threats and they're usually the ones that have pulled them into the office. But they don't realize that the patient's underlying physiology is preventing them from actually following through with action steps. So if we work on a strategy to raise your dopamine levels first and try to do different types of support things to raise your dopamine levels, then that would be an ideal way to start. But dopamine is one of those things where if you don't initiate and get some help to get things going, then it's very hard to get a response. Now, there's lots of different natural supplements that can impact dopamine, but the most effective and aggressive and what shows the best way to raise dopamine levels in the literature isn't a natural supplement, it's just physical activity. Someone to be pushed into moving or exercising and getting the heart rate up, that floods the brain with dopamine. So a lot of times we see patients that are unmotivated, can't follow through protocols, are also not getting any movement in. And as they can get pushed into getting their body to move, that has a dramatic impact on getting dopamine levels in the brain.
It's all about breaking that feedback cycle.
Absolutely.
So, Datis, when we were talking about serotonin, you mentioned depression, and I want to open up the discussion on depression and start off by talking about what is actually happening in the brain when somebody is depressed.
Well, the first thing to understand is depression is really a consequence of a certain area of the brain not working. So when you look at the brain has different regions, but it's the orbitofrontal or prefrontal areas that are not working that causes someone to be depressed. So what that really means is that depression isn't just a neurotransmitter imbalance, it's just a certain area of the brain isn't firing. So if you take anyone's orbitofrontal activity or the frontal lobe activity, and you decrease it from firing, then you can induce depression. And this is what they do in animal studies. In animal studies, the way they do depression studies is they completely limit stimulation activity to the brain. So the frontal lobe activity goes down, and then they have a depressed animal model study that they can use. But, you know, we tend to think of depression as really being a neurotransmitter problem because that's really how the pharmaceutical industry has positioned it, and they use antidepressants. Antidepressants are drugs that impact serotonin or dopamine for the most part. And they're trying to use these drugs to change someone's depressive activity. And the long-term effects of antidepressants are very poor. But for the most part, when we see a patient has depression, we just really, in our model, we don't jump into a neurotransmitter deficiency. We drop into, why is that frontal lobe not working? And everything we talked about so far can impact the frontal lobe. So it doesn't fire, which then leads to depression. So whether it's a blood sugar issue or a lack of oxygen to the brain, or a brain gut axis issue, or an inflammatory response against gluten sensitivity or celiac, or a whole list of things, those can all lead to depression. So I think what I've learned in clinical practice is if I see a patient with depression, the last place I go to is a neurotransmitter imbalance. I really go to these other mechanisms that impact brain function. And that's really the way I teach it to practitioners throughout the country. And also I've summarized it in my brain book.
You touched on SSRIs there, and I'd just love for you to explain why, over time, SSRIs become less effective.
Well, first of all, when you look at meta-analysis studies where they compile a lot of clinical trials that are done, you can see it's very questionable if they actually have any benefits for depression in the first place. So what happens with studies is that when a study is what they call a negative trial where there is no positive results, those data analyses aren't usually published, but still available. So what research scientists have done is they've taken data from clinical trials that have been completed but not published. When they take those clinical trial outcome numbers and compare it with those that have been published, they really show that there's no real effect from these neurotransmitters. For sure, no long-term depression effects, and questionable if there's any short-term depression effects. So if you're really looking at the data analysis and you're looking at the gold standard, which is looking at clinical trials into a composite score of a meta-analysis, you see, first of all, we have to really question if this is even a valid type of protocol. And then research is very clear that these really don't have any beneficial long-term effects. And the question is, like, when someone ends up with, you know, I think they're painting that picture of depression being associated with maybe genetically you're prone to a serotonin dopamine deficiency, so you need this drug to fix it. And I would say for some people that may be true, but it's a very small number. For other people, it's just that their frontal lobe isn't functioning and they're totally depressed. And they, you know, start to take these antidepressants. For those individuals that have an effect with antidepressants, what we also know is they may have a honeymoon period where they have an effect and then just really stops working. That's where they need to really take into these other variables that impact brain function. So we have to be very careful in how much effort we put into just neurotransmitters from a pharmaceutical standpoint, even from a natural standpoint, because there's so many other variables that are more important when it comes to depression.
Thanks for breaking that down. And now I want to shift the conversation into the hormone-brain connection. And in the book, you talk about how hormones significantly impact brain health. So I'd just love for you to talk about this connection.
Yeah, and it's very interesting that the brain has glial cells, and the brain itself actually makes hormones. And the brain is totally dependent upon hormones. So neurons need testosterone, estrogen, progesterone to function well. And there's been a lot of research done with hormones in postmenopausal women, especially. And there's been some research done with men. And with postmenopausal women, the reason there's been so much research done with it was because there is a significant chief complaint when patients start to become postmenopausal with reduced brain function. What they found is that when estrogen levels drop in the brain in women, this is different than in men, that creates activation of cells in the brain called glial cells, which are immune cells in the brain, towards an inflammatory state. So when women become estrogen deficient, they end up with more brain inflammation. And that speeds up neurodegenerative diseases and also, as we talked about, reduces nerve conduction or the speed of neurons fire, so their brain function overall goes down. In men, they find similar findings with low testosterone. So when men's testosterone levels drop, they seem to have an inflammatory response against the brain. So we know that those connections have been published in the literature, but we also know, for example, in men, testosterone also helps activate dopamine receptors, and then estrogen in men and female impacts serotonin receptors. So hormones have their own effect on neurotransmitter pathways in the brain. So hormone deficiencies, hormone imbalances can really impact brain function as well.
And what are your thoughts on hormone replacement therapy? Because this is obviously an area that a lot of women are going to and turning to, especially when they're in menopause.
So hormone replacement therapy, you know, you have people on different sides of it. You have those that just believe it's a thing that everyone should do when they become postmenopausal for bone density reasons and for neuroprotective reasons and so forth. And then you have those that are against hormones because they shouldn't take synthetic hormones. And then you have the anti-aging group that wants to use bioidentical hormones and they want to optimize hormones to a youthful peak. And really, there's a lot of different theories out there and there's a lot of diverse research. So you can kind of be in whatever camp you want and cite whatever research you want and you'd be correct. So if we take it from an evidence-based model perspective, whatever theory you want to believe, there's research for it. So if you want to be concerned about synthetics and estrogen provera for the risk of strokes and embolisms, there's some papers you can find on that, and so on and so on. So for me, in my clinical practice, I really just have a talk with my patient and figure out what their model is for their own healthcare goals and then support them that way. There are definitely patients that we definitely see hormone decline issues and we show them that connection to the research and have them think about if that is appropriate for them and then they kind of choose their own path. But I don't really have a strong opinion one way or the other about HRT because of all the conflicting amounts of information. So I think patient individuality and their own healthcare philosophies is really the best way to determine which way to go. And that's kind of how I do it in my practice.
Okay. And Atis, I feel like there's still a lot of people out there that are fearing cholesterol. And while we're on the subject of hormones, let's talk about how cholesterol is actually important for hormone production.
Yeah, well, cholesterol is an essential component for hormone production and also for brain function in general. So you can have cholesterol too low to have ideal function. So, you know, a typical cholesterol range used to be 260 was normal cholesterol, then it was 240 and then 200 and the numbers keep going down. If you look at it from a researcher perspective, there is research that shows lower cholesterol has a decreased effect on heart disease. So that science is out there. And then on the other hand, there's the science out there in the physiology that really shows there's a point, and clinically you can see when cholesterol levels drop too much, people have significant symptoms of depression and reduced brain activity. So it's another one of those things. It depends what your personal bias is and then how you can use the science to support whatever you want to do. But for me, I definitely do not like to see cholesterol very low. And I think cholesterol lipid panels as the only biomarker to assess your risk for cardiovascular disease is very, very limited. So unless you have oxidized LDL or C-reactive protein and just even blood pressure, you really can't determine cardiovascular risk. So when someone just sees a lipid panel and without looking at the subfractions of cholesterol, other various markers involved with oxidation of lipids to cause atherosclerosis, you don't have the big picture. But that's really what the healthcare system is, this high cholesterol and try to reduce it. If levels of cholesterol start dropping below 150, we see significant symptoms in endocrine function and brain function. So I think people that are on statins or natural compounds to lower their cholesterol, or for various reasons their health impacts their cholesterol metabolism, the levels start to drop below 150 and definitely below 120 total cholesterol, then there can be significant impacts on healthy brain function.
Atis, before we let you go, we have to talk about loss of chemical tolerance. And this is an area I found really fascinating in your book. And this is where certain people can't tolerate things like perfumes, gas fumes, different chemicals in the environment. And Marnie herself is actually quite sensitive to these things. So I just want to open up the conversation and talk about what is happening with these people.
Well, that's a big question. So from a research point of view, from a scientific point of view, immunology point of view, there is a concept called tolerance. And tolerance responds to how you respond to the environment, for example, environmental chemicals. And in order to have healthy tolerance, there's several key players they found are involved. And when they dysfunction, you lose your tolerance and you start to react to chemicals. So there are dendritic cells that are involved. There's permeability that's involved. There's regulatory T cells that are involved. There are Kupffer cell upregulation of liver that's involved. There's metabolites, metabolism. There are biotransformation pathways that are involved. And there's some genetics involved with certain chemical exposures. So I wish I could give you a good answer. And it's not something like you take this botanical and you get rid of it. I mean, when we see patients with tolerance issues, we kind of dissect each one of those pathways and kind of see what's going on with them. But there are things you can do. I will just leave you with the most impactful thing to impact tolerance that we're seeing come out is microbiome diversity. So the gut bacteria you have is shaped by your diet. So the more diverse your diet, specifically to vegetable proteins, the more diverse the gut bacteria become. And these bacteria that you produce each have their own functions and their own enzymes and their own postbiotics or polysaccharides that impact our physiology. So different bacterial species can turn on T-reg cells to impact our tolerance. Different bacterial cells can impact our dendritic cells or various pathways in our body. And the gut microbiome also metabolizes chemicals just like the liver does. But certain bacterial species have certain pathways for certain chemicals. So again, the more diverse it is, the better. But typically see patients that have tolerance issues or even chronically ill patients, they end up also having food restrictions and they only eat the same salad every day. They eat the same vegetables every day. And that's the worst thing they can do. One of the easiest ways to improve your tolerance is to grab as many different vegetables as you can. Maybe try to get 20 different types of vegetables at the health food store and then blend them all up like in a Vitamix and drink it every day. That'll improve your microbiome diversity. The more diverse your microbiome is, the greater potential it has to support your tolerance. It's not that simple, but that's one thing that you can easily say in an interview that can maybe get some patients and some people listening some effective strategy to help them.
And you talk about how chelation therapy isn't safe for these people. How is this so?
Well, the compounds that chelate, like DMPS, DMSA, EDTA, have really shown that they translocate chemicals away from the body into neurological tissue. So we're always worried about chelation when someone has a breached blood-brain barrier. So there are times where chelation is absolutely appropriate, especially if you see very acute levels of chemicals in a body, like someone like lead or some other type of dangerous chemical. And if it can bind to it, and chelation, remember, only binds to heavy metals. It doesn't bind to pesticides. It doesn't bind to BPA or fire retardants. It's very specific to bind to heavy metals. So there's some research that shows that these can push into tissue. So for us, in order for us to even consider a chelation for a patient, unless they have an acute crisis, is to make sure that their tolerance is intact, their blood-brain barrier is intact, the gut barrier is intact, and then they're less likely to have an adverse reaction to chelation.
And why specifically someone who has a loss of chemical tolerance, would they be more susceptible to having a problem with chelation?
So what we found is that when chemicals enter our body, they bind to our proteins. And throughout our blood, an abundant protein is albumin. Albumin allows us to have healthy orthostatic pressure, so we have healthy amounts of transfusion of different nutrients and oxygen through our blood vessels. But when chemicals bind to albumin, they change the structure of the protein and they become neoantigens. So there's a paper that I published with Dr. Vijdani where we found there's a high degree of chemical antibody in the population, and then we followed that research up and showed that when people bind to chemicals, one of the first studies we published was on bisphenol A, BPA, that there's a high degree of neuroinflammation that takes place with it. So if you have someone who's got loss of tolerance and the chemicals are binding to the proteins, they're making new antigens. Those new antigens can induce brain inflammation. So you take a person, for example, that has a certain amount of toxic load, their chemicals are binding to the proteins, creating new antigens, causing brain inflammation, and they have a leaky gut barrier. Their body's clearance pathways for chemicals in their liver and through their microbiome are compromised. you do chelation with them, you're going to devastate them. So there is some degree of health you need to have to not have adverse reactions to chelation.
So in wrapping up, is there anything that we haven't talked about yet in relation to brain health that you think that we should cover before we let you go?
It's such a broad question. I mean, there's a lot.
Or any little tip, just some little lasting thoughts, something that people can implement right away.
I would say if you're really looking at your brain health, there's no real magic supplement. The key things that are critical to have healthy brain function is, number one, sleep. You have to sleep. Your brain has no chance if you don't get sleep. Number two, your brain needs growth factors and it needs blood flow and circulation. And really the only way that happens is through some exercise. So any kind of daily exercise routine of any kind is critical for brain function. And then the brain needs opioids and growth factors that keep it healthy. And psychoneuroimmune studies show positive relationships are critical. So when you kind of look at the key things for brain health, it's really about getting sleep, getting exercise, being healthy relationships. Then you combine that with a diet low in sugar and carbohydrates, with lots of vegetable protein diversity and lots of good fats. That's a winning model to support your brain.
I agree. That's amazing. And other than our listeners getting a copy of Why Isn't My Brain Working, which is an incredibly comprehensive book, over 500 pages of amazing information, how else can our listeners connect with you?
So one of the things that happened when we published that brain book is we got a lot of positive feedback. We also had a lot of patients tell us, my brain's not healthy enough to implement these strategies. So I did create a 6-week course. It's an online program. We teach patients every week. We give them a workbook. We have them take action steps each week. And we kind of go through all the key steps that people need to do to improve their brain function. So we take the key factors that have impact on the brain with the most significant impact. And then each week we kind of go down through each one of these. And typically when we have people go through all 6 weeks, most people that have gone through the program notice dramatic changes in their brain. I can share on my webpage, Dr. K News, we have a 6-week brain program that people can take. And it's really the next level from the book. Or for people that have a hard time reading, or they need more direct steps to take, that's a great way to follow some of the suggestions we talk about in the brain book.
That's great, Tatis. We're going to link up the program. We're going to link up the book and everything else we talked about today over at ultimatehealthpodcast.com for the listeners. And we just want to thank you for coming back on the show. This has been super informative. A lot of fun talking to you. And thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation with Tatis. So much great information about brain health. And we also hope that you subscribe to our show. This is so important to us. So whatever device you are listening to our show on right now, subscribe. This helps to boost our show in the charts. It also will allow other people to find our show more easily. This is so helpful to us and something that we ask you to do today.
Subscribing is easy to do, and we'd really appreciate it. Before we let you guys go, I want to give some love to our editor and engineer, Jace Sanderson, over at podcasttech.com. Jace, thanks for doing such a great job putting the show together. And this week's fun fact about Jace is that he's liking the idea of keeping a real photo album in scrapbook and breaking his social media habit. Real photos mean so much more. Jace, I love this idea, and I agree with you. Listeners, have an awesome week. We'll talk soon. Take care.